From Rotary Magazine, this is the Rotary Voices Podcast. I'm Steve Edwards. On the coastal bluffs of San Diego, California, two buildings mirror each other across a sweeping courtyard. Situated on 27 acres, the buildings house spacious laboratories dedicated to scientific collaboration. A man-made river runs across the courtyard, before spilling into the Pacific Ocean. It's called the River of Life. It represents the steady flow of scientific discoveries from this campus into the world's greater body of knowledge. This is the Salk Institute. Dr. Jonas Salk was a virologist and medical researcher. He helped design the Salk Institute in the hopes that the large, open, and unobstructed laboratory spaces would adapt to the ever-changing needs of science.
If we could understand genetics, immunology, and neurobiology, we would have the basic sciences to deal with all of the problems of humankind.
Dr. Salk famously developed the first safe and effective polio vaccine, an accomplishment that would define his legacy.
Nicknamed the shot heard round the world, one of the greatest triumphs in medical history is achieved.
Brilliant, tireless, determined, Dr. Salk painstakingly developed a vaccine to prevent paralytic polio.
Today, the person in charge of that legacy is his eldest son, Dr. Peter Salk.
I feel a devotion to my father. I feel a responsibility to help make sure that his ways of thinking and his contributions are understood.
Peter Salk is president and director of the Jonas Salk Legacy Foundation. The foundation works to preserve and extend his father's scientific contributions, particularly with polio. Peter is also a researcher and a part-time professor of infectious diseases and microbiology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health. Over the years, he worked with his father in his laboratory at the Salk Institute, conducting cancer research and later working to develop a vaccine for HIV infection. But Peter was also there on the day that his father's legacy was cemented. In 1953, at the age of 9 years old, Peter became one of the first people to receive his father's polio vaccine. 2 years later, in 1955, Dr. Jonas Salk and his colleague Dr. Thomas Francis Jr. made an announcement at the University of Michigan.
The vaccine could be considered 80 to 90% effective against paralytic poliomyelitis.
Chief Evaluator Dr. Thomas Francis pronounces the vaccine tests up to 90% effective.
It is the climactic moment as Dr. Francis pronounces the most dramatic words in medical annals, the vaccine works.
Within 1 year, polio cases and deaths in America were nearly halved, a trend that continued and made polio eradication a possibility.
In 1955, over 10 million children received one or more injections of Salk vaccine.
The vaccines developed by Dr. Salk and other pioneers saved countless lives and healed the world. Since 1988, Rotary and its partners in the Global Polio Eradication Initiative have reduced wild poliovirus cases by 99.9%. As of 2023, they've brought down the number of cases worldwide from 350,000 to 12, and the number of countries affected from 125 to just 2. In addition, more than 20 million people are now able to walk today who would otherwise have been paralyzed. I recently spoke with Dr. Peter Salk about immunizations and polio eradication, hoping to gain his perspective as both a medical researcher and the keeper of his family's legacy. We began our conversation with a bit of family history. Dr. Jonas Salk was born exactly 3 months after World War I began. His parents were Russian Jewish immigrants living in New York City.
His mother had come over from Belarus, and his father's parents had come over from Lithuania. His mother was a domineering woman. His growing up was completely marked by the relationship that he had with her. He was someone who was just from the earliest times wanting to do something to be helpful for humanity.
What do you think it was about his upbringing or his own nature that inspired him toward this
life of trying to help others, that sense of commitment to public service and altruism.
Yeah. I don't know that I can really parse that out of the whole picture. I know there was a memory burnt into him of 1918, Armistice Day, at the end of World War One, and there being a parade and his seeing soldiers coming back from the wars with having been injured, maimed, and wheelchairs or crutches or whatever it was, and just being really struck by that. So I think he always had a sensitive nature. There was a generosity of spirit about him and wanting to help others. I think that this was part and parcel of his makeup.
As time went on, Jonas considered being trained in law and getting elected to Congress.
His mother very astutely advised him that this was not a good decision because he couldn't even win an argument with her. I think she wanted him to become a rabbi, whatever it was. It all worked out.
He decided to go to City College in New York, where his studies took an unexpected turn.
And in his first year, there was an opportunity for him to take a chemistry course, and this was appealing to him. He wanted to do that. Problematically, the course met on a Saturday, and this was a Jewish household, as his parents seriously followed the Jewish practices and traditions, and he had a tough choice to make. He ended up making the decision that he was going to do that.
He ended up having such a positive experience training in the sciences that he set his sights on medical school, even knowing early on that he wanted to go into research. As the first member of his family to attend college, he enrolled in the New York University School of Medicine.
It might have even been the first year that there was a microbiology class where the professor was talking about vaccines.
There were two sequential lectures that sparked Jonas's interest in vaccines. The first lecture was about preventing bacterial infections with vaccines. To give you a quick science lesson, when you get vaccinated against tetanus, for example, you're getting an injection of a neutralized toxin from the tetanus bacteria. That way, your immune system is able to recognize the toxin and create antibodies against it. So Jonas learned this in that first lecture.
Then in the next lecture, the professor was talking about viral diseases. And he said, with viral diseases, you can't do that. In order to develop a protective immune response against a virus disease, the body has to have the experience of an actual infection. And my father just couldn't understand that. If the immune system works the way he thought the immune system worked, that just did not make any sense to him. He actually asked the professor why that was, and the professor's response was basically, well, just because. So that sort of started my father out in the angle of, can you make a killed or inactivated vaccine against a viral disease?
At the time, Dr. Thomas Francis Jr. was a professor at the NYU School of Medicine, where Dr. Salk was studying. And it turned out he was also interested in this question of vaccinating against a viral disease.
So they did preliminary work together while he was in medical school, and that was just such a seminal experience.
After Dr. Salk did a 2-year clinical internship at Mount Sinai Hospital, his path crossed with Dr. Francis again at the University of Michigan. Dr. Francis was the head of the epidemiology department there, and they began working together for a second time. But now they were totally focused on developing a working influenza vaccine based on the use of a killed virus.
So it was 1942 that my father went to work with Thomas Francis, and by 1945, they had a vaccine that was introduced for use in the armed forces. So this was a quick project. Dr. Francis had been working on it before. My father just really took hold and was a very important member of that team. And then after a couple of years beyond that, he was getting rested and felt that he wanted to go off on his own and have more of his own responsibility. Came to the University of Pittsburgh in 1947.
Meanwhile, in 1947, at the University of Pittsburgh, has arrived a 33-year-old research professor named Dr. Jonas E. Salk. His specialty, virus research. Salk soon heads up Pittsburgh's virus research laboratory. He becomes interested in polio, receives a National Foundation grant for polio research.
And very quickly, a relationship was established with the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, and he became part of a collaborative that was focused on determining how many different types, immunologic types of poliovirus there were since any polio vaccine would have to include all the different types. So that relationship with Dr. Francis was formative, and he'll loop back into the picture later because he had such a major role, Dr. Francis, to play in the huge national field trial that later took place with the first vaccine.
So that places us in 1947. Dr. Salk goes to the University of Pittsburgh and starts researching the different strains of poliovirus. But before we go ahead with Dr. Salk's story, we need to zoom out.
In post-war America, the wail of ambulance sirens, the sight of feverish little faces and bodies immobilized by pain and paralysis becomes an all-too-familiar picture. Each year, there are epidemics in different areas, followed by the ritual of closed pools, parks, and other public places where children gather.
Theaters and stores were closed up tight. Each headline looks like yesterday's, only worse.
As polio hits again, and again, and again, and again, and the terrible total mounts.
From the late 40s through the early 50s, Americans experienced several polio epidemics. Cases soared, and just a few years later, they hit a new record high.
For some strange reason, the number of paralytic polio cases skyrockets. Where will it end?
What was the scale of the polio epidemic at that time?
Things were getting worse and worse and worse. Polio has been with humanity for thousands of years, but it wasn't a large-scale problem in the way it later became. And the reason for that is that sanitation was primitive. And poliovirus enters through the mouth, grows in the intestinal tract, and then is excreted and gets passed. And it also can be passed by coughing and sneezing and so on. And kids, everybody was exposed. Children that were born had antibodies from their mothers passed to the placenta and the breast milk. And when they were exposed very early on, they were protected from the maternal antibodies. So it wasn't that frequent that a child would actually become paralyzed.
So if I understand you correctly, the irony is, as we improve sanitation standards, that actually had the unintended negative consequence of making us more susceptible.
Yep, that's exactly what happened, because kids were not exposed early on. And by the time they accidentally encountered the poliovirus, the antibodies from their mother had gone. So this was when the epidemics began to start. So this was towards the end of the 1800s, early 1900s. By the end of the 1940s, it was just getting worse and worse and worse every year. 1952 was the worst year, with about 58,000 people, primarily children, infected with the virus. This was in the United States. Worldwide, it was probably on the order of 600,000 people a year that were infected.
I'm curious, do you have any personal recollection of that time?
I have a number of memories. One was one summer. I'm in Ohio now, close by where we used to go on vacations in Pittsburgh, and wanted to go to an amusement park. And parents said no. That was probably the most direct experience. I also remember our family accompanied my father to a polio meeting at the Greenbrier in West Virginia. And there was a swimming pool under the building, and seeing a girl there who was crippled. And for whatever reason, I mean, that just really had an impact on me.
In 1952, the worst polio epidemic hit the United States. Life fundamentally changed. Many people avoided crowds and public gatherings, from sporting events to local swimming pools. Children were often isolated by their parents for fear that they would get polio.
Here on this Saturday, there should be picnics in progress, children playing on the green grass. Here, there should be splashing, swimming, sun-kissed children. Here, the ball team should be in action this summer Saturday.
And while you're all in the pool having fun in the sun, be on the lookout for those chattering teeth and shivers that mean a chill.
People who did have polio were treated in isolation wards, some placed in iron lungs, which are large machines that help polio patients breathe when their breathing muscles are paralyzed. Wheelchairs and braces became symbols of the disease.
Correct and constant care is vitally important, especially when all but your head is encased in an iron lung.
emergency equipment, special nurses, and consultants have been rushed to help them by the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis.
But we must face the fact that any one of these could be the next victim of infantile paralysis, for this visible crippler of America's children knows no season. It can happen anywhere, anytime.
Panic was taking hold of the country, and the need for a vaccine was becoming increasingly clear.
So approximately 58,000 cases in the early 1950s in the United States and continuing to grow. In 1953, your father and his team have been working actively trying to determine how to develop a vaccine that would be effective against multiple strains of the poliovirus. They start testing, and my understanding is that he tested the experimental vaccine on himself, and then soon after tested it on his family, including a young 9-year-old Peter Salk. So tell us more about what you remember from that time as a family really moving into this very important but unknown space around the fight to eradicate, at least alleviate the polio epidemic.
It was in 1952 that the very first studies in humans were done. So this is a year before the time that you're referring to. And those studies started out at the Watson Home, what was then the D.T. Watson Home for Crippled Children outside of Pittsburgh. And these were kids who were crippled for one reason or another, and primarily from polio. So doing the initial studies in that group of kids was done for safety. There are only three types of poliovirus. If a child had had an infection and was paralyzed from, let's say, the type 1 virus, and you injected that child with a chemically inactivated type 1 virus, they would be protected. They were not going to be able to become paralyzed because they already had been infected by a virus of that type. So the goal of those initial studies was to determine if you have kids who'd already had polio and you inject them with an inactivated virus preparation, will the antibody levels be boosted? The answer was yes. And when that answer came, as far as my father was concerned, it was done.
With the help of patients at the D.T. Watson Home for Crippled Children, Dr. Salk and his team had successfully applied the same logic of the inactivated flu vaccine to their experimental polio vaccine. Their studies expanded into another school further north. Peter says that around 160 kids were involved in those early studies, but it became apparent that in order to do a real full-scale test, Dr. Salk's team needed a lot more information.
All the details of how do you do the inactivation procedure so that you can be completely confident that there's not going to be any residual live virus left. What about the timing of the injections to optimize the immune response and so on?
In addition to their studies, Dr. Salk decided to add a few more subjects to the mix.
It was just at that junction point in the spring of 1953 that it was time to begin to recruit larger numbers of people. And I don't know actually when he first had himself injected and other lab members. That may have been even earlier than this, but that was the time at which the family was brought into the picture.
So Dr. Salk would inject his family with the vaccine.
When you inoculate children with a polio virus, he later confides, you don't sleep well for 2 or 3 weeks. But Salk is the father of 3 children. And this summer, polio has killed over 3,100, mostly children. Salk inoculates his own children.
So it was in the early part of May of 1953. And you can imagine the family of 3 sons, 9 years old, 6 years old, and not quite 3 years old, were not very happy to be part of this joyful experience. We lived in the country outside of Pittsburgh, and then my father came home with the experimental vaccine preparation from the laboratory, proceeded to sterilize the lovely equipment of glass syringes and metal needles in on the kitchen stove, filled the syringes and lined us up, and there we went. I was absolutely not a fan of needles. And the strangest thing, and I've told the story many times, but it's just absolutely the case, that day is burnt into my mind forever, because as I stood there, not being happy at all, having my arm held in that position, looking out the kitchen window, I didn't feel the needle that day. something miraculous happened, and wherever the nerves were in the arm, it missed them. So if it had hurt like any other shot, I probably wouldn't remember it. But somehow that sort of emblazoned the experience in my mind.
Next, all the laboratory tests had to be verified with clinical tests on humans. And they were, through the cooperation of patients at the D.T. Watson home in Pennsylvania. Slowly, with great care, the preliminary testing was carried out.
1953 was the year that he first published the results from the studies that had started at the Watson home for crippled children. And the news was leaked beforehand by a reporter.
When the successful results were announced, the news created tremendous excitement.
And my father and the National Foundation knew that something had to be done to put people on the right track and not have expectations for something that wasn't right around the corner. But there was great promise in the work that had been done up to this point.
Now the time had come to try the new trial polio vaccine on a larger scale. In 1954, the most extraordinary field trial in medical history took place. Nearly 2 million children took part.
So in 1954, the end of April, a huge field trial was undertaken with 1.8 million children, primarily in the United States, some Canada, some overseas.
This is where Dr. Thomas Francis Jr. comes back into the picture. He was put in charge of analyzing the results of that field trial, which took a year. At this point, it was out of Dr. Salk's hands, and he was kept in the dark. Dr. Francis kept a lid on everything, until...
On April 12th of 1955, the results of that analysis were going to be presented. My father had no idea until that morning at breakfast. Dr. Francis announced the results, then Rackham Hall in Ann Arbor, and pandemonium. Oh, boost. The vaccine was 80 to 90% effective, safe, and potent. And I even get goose pimples thinking about that right now. Just seeing the scenes of April 12th when the announcement was made and kids were let out of school and church bells rang and factory whistles blew. The thing that was so extraordinary was that all of fear that had pervaded this country for so many years was lifted. How many times does something like that happen in a single stroke?
That breakthrough in the development of the polio vaccine, it was heralded as one of the great medical and scientific breakthroughs, not only of the 20th century, certainly, but arguably of medical and scientific history, and ushering in a new age, not just for the public health crisis that the polio epidemic represented, but the way we think about modern epidemiological response and the development of vaccines.
And this was not a question of having government grants and so on to do research. This was an effort that was dependent on the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis and its fundraising arm, the March of Dimes. All of the funds that went into the development of the vaccine at the University of Pittsburgh, this came from the people of this country. Knowing that there was no way to know when this disease was going to affect your own child, people were highly motivated to contribute to this cause, not only of helping people who had had polio, but of getting a vaccine to prevent it. So we just had to recognize that this was the people of this country who were behind this.
While the contribution of some may seem greater than that of others, this gigantic experiment is symbolic of the equally great foundations, both scientific and philanthropic, without which it could not have been conceived or executed.
And it's remarkable to think about what an important moment was, not for just for society, but as you put it so eloquently, for individuals, for parents of young children, for families and others that lived in fear. How do you, as you think about the recent experience we've had as a society around the development and rollout of the COVID vaccines, what comparisons do you draw between that moment and process versus this more recent experience, if any?
Between that time in the 1950s and the present era, a lot of vaccines came out and were highly effective. And in a sense, the whole process of vaccine development and application became a victim of its own success, because these childhood illnesses that people had been plagued with, mumps, measles, German measles, diphtheria, whooping cough, these were a thing of the past, basically. This was not something that was constantly on parents' mind. So as time went on, there are all sorts of reasons people might have about vaccines. And with the COVID pandemic, there was as much fear as there was about the illness, there also was fear about the vaccines. And some of that is just sort of generic in a way of vaccines having been looked at in a bad light, that there had been so many things that had gone on in previous years having to do with specters of autism, which had no basis in reality. So people were sensitized, and it took a lot to get over that hump. We really did, as a scientific community, an extraordinary job. And I have to give credit to the government for having stepped behind that and helped to speed things up in the best way that they could. It was amazing how quickly that process went. And I'm so grateful that these vaccines made it on the scene and could take the edge off of one's own helplessness and fear. And at least there was something one could do for oneself in face of this illness that, for me at least, was just absolutely terrifying.
You referenced vaccine skepticism in recent decades and growth of the anti-vax community as part of that process. From your perspective as a researcher, epidemiologist, expert on this entire field, what is being done and what needs to be done to counter those narratives?
Well, I'll tell you something that I was involved with in this back in 2015, 2016. It made some progress and then things got derailed a bit. I think it's really important to move the discussion of vaccines and immunity back from the critical moments of parents having to make decisions for their children on the spot. There needs to be education earlier on when pregnancy is ongoing to make sure that parents understand the lay of the land with respect to vaccines. And earlier than that, get this into the schools, get this into the high schools, conceivably the middle schools, some education about the immune system, what vaccines are, how they work, what actually is known, what the realities are about issues. And one has to be careful and understanding that, yes, vaccines can have side effects, and that has to be dealt with openly and objectively, and decisions made appropriately on that basis. So it is important for people to have the basis of understanding to make good decisions for their children. But we also have to be careful on the other side of things, not to push things under the rug if there are real problems that need to be dealt with. And this all plays itself out with the polio eradication experience that we're having, because there are problems that have to be dealt with realistically.
One example of these problems is what's called the vaccine-derived poliovirus, which brings us to our second science lesson. Up until this point, we've been discussing the wild poliovirus, which is the most commonly known form. It's been around since prehistoric times. However, there's another form of poliovirus that came about with the emergence of a different polio vaccine than Dr. Salk's. This is the oral polio vaccine. The Global Polio Eradication Initiative, a program that Rotary helped found, uses this form of vaccine because it's easier to administer, it's also inexpensive, and can be distributed quickly on a large scale. It's helped reduce global polio cases by over 99% since 1988. It uses a weakened live poliovirus that replicates in the intestine. It's then excreted and can be spread to others in close contact, meaning that this form of immunization can result in a, quote, passive immunization of unvaccinated people. While the vaccine is safe and extremely effective, the weakened vaccine virus can pass through a community with low immunization rates, and in rare instances over time, genetically revert to a form of the virus that can cause paralysis. This is known as variant poliovirus, which is now the most prevalent form of polio. As part of the endgame strategy for polio eradication to boost immunity against all polioviruses, including the variant poliovirus, the Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization, which advises the World Health Organization, recommends all countries introduce 2 doses of the Salk vaccine into routine immunization systems.
So what's the major problem today? It's not wild poliovirus. The major problem is caused by the circulating virus. As far as I'm concerned, we have to put these in the same basket. If we want to eliminate and eradicate polio globally, it's all got to go. And so that's the task that's in front of us right now, is how do we finish getting this job done?
One question I would just ask, given the complexity that you've painted and the fact that we have 2 effective but not wholly perfect vaccine approaches, is it possible to eradicate the poliovirus in your view, fully?
I think so. I think we're going to do it. I'll throw a few things into the mix. Number one, a new approach to inactivating the virus. There is a new vaccine, a new live attenuated vaccine that's now in use called NOPV type 2 that's based on new fancy chemical ways, genetic ways of getting the virus inactivated in a way that will markedly reduce its ability to mutate into a dangerous form. When I say markedly reduce, I'm using it with advisement. It has looked quite good. Whether it's perfect is another question. More time will tell, but it's a big step. There's so much that has to be done on the ground in terms of getting these vaccines out and into people. I think we're going to be in a situation where we're going to be seeing incremental progress. Getting the injected vaccine back into the picture through routine immunization efforts, I think, is going to be helpful, because that should provide a layer of immunity, despite the fact that there may be some weaknesses in the protection caused by the live vaccine. So somehow, I think that we're going to find our way through this. Rotary has been a champion in continuing to put an emphasis on getting this job done. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, with their contributions, the other organizations that are involved in the Global Polio Eradication Initiative. Everyone is trying hard, and practical work is being done on the ground, trying to deal with the social issues and so on that are impediments to having full of the effective vaccination program. So I think we're going to do it.
And I was just curious what you see in terms of how his legacy will move forward in the next, 10, 20, 30 years.
The work that my father and Tommy Francis did with the influenza vaccine, and then my father and his team at the University of Pittsburgh on polio, demonstrated the effectiveness of killed or inactivated vaccines. And that has led to the surge of vaccines made from genetically engineered surface materials, and even the RNA vaccines and so on. That all of that is part of the legacy of the work that my father did. My father wrote 4 books, Man Unfolding, The Survival of the Wisest, World Population and Human Values, A New Reality. That's the book he wrote with my brother Jonathan. It's now called A New Reality, Human Evolution for a Sustainable Future, and Anatomy of Reality, Merging of Intuition and Reason. I'm just saying those titles just to give you a sense of where his thinking was. If I had my brothers, that's the realm that I really would like to see elaborated. And let's get the job done with some practical outcomes. All of the theorizing wouldn't do anything, but there was a vaccine in a bottle that did something. We can have grand desires for the human species, and we need to make use of some real practical tools that can have direct impact in those realms.
We spent this conversation talking about your father's work. We spent the last part of this conversation talking about the work that you've been involved in and that the broader global public health community is continuing to be involved in. What is it that's inspired you to pursue this path, to follow in many respects in the steps that your father has set forward, and also to expand and go beyond in many respects the work that he did?
Yeah, it was hard to avoid the vacuum created behind my father in terms of the wake behind the boat as a child. For all three of us as sons, each of us had our own interests and angles and loves of other things that had nothing to do with science. And each of the three of us in our own ways have tried to incorporate those things in our lives, but each of us found ourselves in medical school. In one way or another, working with my father. I worked in the laboratory at the Salk Institute. My next brother down, Darryl, worked very intensively on polio vaccination issues. My brother, Jonathan, worked with him in many respects and co-authored a book with him, which then Jonathan has revised and so on, or some of the broader aspects of his thinking. It's been a hard route to go in a way. It's been wonderful and challenging and full of opportunities, but there's always just been a tug of war, I think, among all three of us. How do we work this out in our lives? I feel a sense of responsibility and have to having people understand my father, what his contributions were, not only in these realms we've been talking about today, but with the broader issues confronting humanity, and these broader issues that are now part and parcel of what we have to deal with if we're going to get this job done with polio. How do we deal with the issues of inequalities, of poverty, of the differences in cultural values that separate us, wars, the environment? And these now are issues that have to come front and center. And I just know from my own side, because peace has been an area that really has been of major importance to me, and I know that that's the case for Rotary as well, we've got to come to terms with this as human beings and use whatever approaches we can to help create a softer atmosphere globally if we're going to get through the hard challenges that confront us, not only with respect to infectious diseases, but with respect to all of the other issues that there are out there. So from my side, I feel a devotion to my father. I feel a responsibility to help make sure that his ways of thinking and his contributions are understood. There were also ways in which he and I thought differently, and I really have my own angle of thinking about how we can approach this, dealing practically with some of these underlying issues about my father used it, and I'm breaking off there just to say that there was one expression that my father used that has stuck with me. He was talking about immunization and humanization of mankind, and forgive the man part, that's part of the way expressions were in those days. And the immunization part has to do with reducing the negative. Let's protect against the problem that we have and infectious diseases and so on. Humanization is part of enhancing the positive. So we've got to turn our attention to both realms. And if I had another life to live at the same time, I would probably be doing more on the latter side of things, the humanizing scope, than the former.
What are some examples of ways your life and your work have intersected with Rotary?
Well, I've had the great pleasure of being invited on many occasions to speak with Rotary groups, and I've just loved it. I think the spirit of people who are involved with Rotary, their desire to help the world, it's been very uplifting in all of those occasions where I've had chances to, you know, spend time with and interact with people who are members of Rotary. So I'm appreciative not only of the major contributions you have made, and it's indispensable, I mean, what you have done in terms of putting a focus on polio. This was the beginning of everything. You just created this momentum. Other people joined in, but this is your spirit that has driven this. And just the personal interactions. And it's just the people have been wonderful to meet and to get to know.
Dr. Salk, let me just thank you not only for your time in this conversation, but for your work specifically. We're grateful for it and grateful for the thoughts and insights and stories you've shared with us today. Dr. Peter Salk is president of the Jonas Salk Legacy Foundation and professor of infectious disease and microbiology at the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health. Dr. Salk, thank you again and all the best to you.
Thank you, Steve, and all of the team. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
This episode of the Rotary Voices podcast was produced by J.P. Swenson and edited by Wen Wong, with help from Diana Schoberg, Carol Pandak, and Sarah Tetzlaff. It was edited and mixed by Mike Novak. Special thanks to the March of Dimes for providing archival tape for this episode. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share it with your friends. The Rotary Voices podcast is produced by Rotary Magazine, the official monthly publication of Rotary International. I'm Steve Edwards. Thanks for listening.